from his work.
I'd like to call to order this meeting of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee on March 4th. And we have minutes from. Wednesday, February 9th, last time the full committee, February 11th, 2009, last time the full committee met. We've been meeting in the election subcommittee. Are there corrections or additions to the minutes?
Minutes.
Senator Betzel moves that the minutes for Wednesday, February 11th, 2009, be approved. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We have a long agenda that we hope we can accomplish in our allotted time. If we can't, I will move my bills to the bottom of the agenda and we can do them some other time. The first bill on the agenda is Senate File 709, Senator Bonoff. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to present a bill that is a municipal street improvement district. We have a wonderful opportunity in Minnetonka at this time when we know that so many people are losing their jobs, and we have a strong need to create jobs and put people to work. There is a desire on the behalf of some companies in our community to expand, and this expansion would actually create 3,000 jobs. This expansion would put 2,000 people to work immediately, as well as 1,000 construction jobs. And so I have brought the city manager, John Gagne, with me to talk about the project. But before we talk about the project, I wanted to move two amendments. I have the A3 amendment. And just to explain, when the bill was originally drafted, we wanted to create a funding mechanism for two different places in Minnetonka. We knew that at the interchange of Bren Road and Highway 169, that there are the Opus complex is right there, United Health Group's headquarters is there, and United Health Group would like to expand dramatically in that location. But because of the way the interchange is, that interchange could not withstand the expansion. There would be too much traffic. In addition, we knew we wanted to do some redevelopment in the Ridgedale area, particularly when we thought Nordstrom's was going to be coming to Ridgedale. You may have read in the newspaper, Nordstrom's is no longer planning to come to Ridgedale. And so we have removed that section of the improvement district from the bill. So right now, the bill is only dealing with the Bren Road Highway 169 interchange. So the A3 amendment takes out the 394 area, as well as one of the requirements of the municipal district, the maintenance requirement. So
Lurie moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. You also have the A4 amendment, Senator Bonoff?
Yes, Madam Chair. The A4 amendment is some technical changes to the bill based on responses from the affected business community, making sure that they get plenty of notice to hear about this plan. So it's several different modifications to the bill based on the feedback of the Twin West Chamber and the businesses in the area.
Senator Lurie moves adoption of the A4 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendments are adopted. Senator Bonoff, would you like to go through your bill for us, first of all, and we'll hear from your advocates, and we'll also hear from any opponents.
Actually, Madam Chair, I thought I would let Mr. Gagneau take us through the bill and talk about the project first, and then I would come back and add some things before
Gagneau,
we take
if you
testimony.
Would, identify yourself, please, for the record, and explain this proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Gagneau. I'm the city manager of the city of Minnetonka. Senator Bonhoff is carrying this bill at our request. There's a handout. There are two handouts that are at your table. One is the picture that shows the interchange improvement. It's shown in yellow. And then there's a question and answer sheet that explains some of the details of the bill. I'd like to just sort of briefly go through some of those points. One is that why is this needed? What it does is it gives us the authority to create a district in the Opus Office Park. It's an office park in one area of our city that can be used to pay for the local matching requirements and local improvements for transportation improvements. As Senator Bonhoff mentioned, even in this economy, we have a major expansion that is ready to go tomorrow. One of our major businesses in the area is ready to begin construction as soon as we can create the capacity. And as she mentioned, that we cannot allow any additional development in this office park until this interchange is rebuilt. There are 1,800 very well-paying, good jobs will be permanently created in addition to the 900 constructions and about 850 indirect jobs, another couple thousand with the expansion in future years. The reason we're asking for this is that it's a mechanism that allows the businesses that will directly benefit from those improvements to pay for that. The businesses that need to expand and cannot expand unless we do this, and so that really, I think, from a tax policy standpoint, is probably the most fair and transparent way to do it. Similarly, the way we already have the authority to expand water, sewer, wastewater utilities, but we do not have the authority to do that for road improvements. It's only for the capital. One of the amendments that Senator Bonhoff offered was it would not allow us to raise funding for maintenance funding. So this would just be for the capital projects. We would continue to pay for the normal maintenance out of the property taxes that the businesses in the area pay. It also would only apply to the commercial businesses. There is some residential housing in that area, but they would not be included. The way the fees would be allocated is we would work with the businesses in the area. The process that's specified in the bill requires us to do that through the normal set of public hearings and work to develop some sort of mechanism that would fairly allocate these fees. They would be based on property value, trip generation, those people that would most directly benefit from this, as well as proximity. That's something that's not possible under current law. Special assessment districts don't work in situations like this. In fact, I think you'll notice that cities do not use special assessment districts for large projects like this because it only looks at value. There's no way to also consider the other benefits that are available. The only other alternative for us to meet the local match requirements on this is to tax all of our property taxes, all of our properties throughout the city, every homeowner, every that might live 3 or 4 miles away, and we just didn't think that was fair. The other funding, this is a $20 million project. We're working very closely with both MnDOT and DEED have been very helpful, and we've identified about half of those funds through various sources that they're working on. This mechanism would allow us to raise about a quarter of those funds. We would do it through a loan through MnDOT, has agreed to do that. We would then pay it back over a number of years with the fees that would be generated from this. I did want to recognize that. In fact, I just noticed a handout that you got about the oppose the street improvement fee. It looks surprisingly similar to one that was passed out every year for just about every year some sort of street improvement district comes before you. I think most of the information in here does not apply to this bill. This bill is very tightly drafted so that it only applies to this improvement, this office park, and it would allow the businesses that are in this park to pay for that. And I should note that the two largest businesses in that area, United Health Group and Opus Corporation, have authorized me to say that they publicly support this legislation.
Mr. Gunyer, where does it say in the bill upon which property the fees are going to be imposed? Where is that? What kinds of property?
Let's see. Which section?
The district is defined.
Oh, Madam Chair, it's the district that's defined in the beginning. So it's on the second page, and that would be establishment of the district. It's the Smetana Road in the north, 169, Trunk Highway, and Shady Oak Road in the west.
But
it's,
you mentioned that there were some residential properties that were being
there
excluded.
There are, but they're not included. In fact, you'll see on Section 1, Subdivision 1B, it says eligible property. It says real property that is not residential.
See. That's what I was looking for. And that, so that is single-family homes, apartments. What is that?
All residential, whether it's multifamily, townhomes, apartments. It would only be those that are classified commercial.
Okay. Thank you. You may continue.
Oh, actually, that concluded my remarks.
Okay.
I'd be glad to answer any questions you might
and
have.
Madam
Are there
Chair,
any questions for Mr. Gunyer or Senator Bonhoeffer?
Well, Madam Chair, before we move on to that, I just wanted to comment that I've been in conversations with MnDOT for, I would say, 2 years maybe a year or so, but with regard to this interchange. And so MnDOT has been working very hard to come up with ways to fund this project. And so with the stimulus dollars, we are hopeful that that would be able to pay for a large portion of that. And so please understand that should we get other funds, they would not use this. This would be a last resort. If, you know, it turned out the city did not need to pay a local match, we would be thrilled for that.
And this bill, if we act favorably on it, is going to go to the Transportation Committee, just for the information. Are there questions or comments at this point for Senator Bonhoeff or Mr. Gunyer? Then we will proceed to the witnesses. And we have Jeremy Eftenson from the Chamber. Beg pardon? I'm sorry. I understand that Mr. Horner needs to go first. Welcome to the committee. If you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jack Horner. I'm representing the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Madam Chair, members, Senator Bonhoeff. First of all, I think it's important in light of ongoing discussions and so on to make it very clear that neither I nor any member of this large group of organizations that has a major concerns about this bill is speaking against these business expansions or against the city of Minnetonka or in any way not wanting them to prosper and succeed. We hope that it does. We have great esteem for the city manager, for the author of the bill, et cetera. Unfortunately, we have to address the bill that's in front of you today. Now, we've heard there are amendments coming. We are open to discussion that would make it extremely narrow, only to this project, no precedential value, et cetera, but we can only talk to what we have before us. And unfortunately, the mechanism before you is one that our organization and many others have a long history, 10 or more years of opposing virtually every year, and virtually every year the legislature has turned down this proposal in one form or another. And the form that you have before you is a little bit narrower. I mean, it is limited to only one part of a city, not a whole city, like the statewide bills have been. And it's only limited to non-residential, includes all other kinds of property. So it is a bit narrower. But in every essential way, it's identical to the proposals that the legislature has consistently turned down year after year after year. And that's the bill that we are addressing, and that's what we have to address. The bill creates a new or authorizes cities to create a new property tax. And they call it a fee, I know, but it is in every respect, has all the characteristics of a tax, and has none of the characteristics of a fee. It is a tax on property. It's a property tax. But it is totally without any restriction or limitation according to the language of the bill, which is what we're commenting on. The city council of a city, in this case Minnetonka, alone creates the district. They decide what it looks like. Maybe it looks like an amoeba, which businesses are in, which businesses aren't in. We don't know why, what the rationale is. Some are, some aren't. City council alone has the total authority to do that. Secondly, the city council is authorized to create, literally create, a brand new property tax system. Maybe it's based on trip generation, these complex formulas in this 1,000-page book that some of you have seen that highway engineers use to assess road capability or road capacity. Maybe it's based on value. What value, we don't know, because it's not regulated. Taxable value, referendum value, estimated value. Maybe it's on proximity to the road, or is in discussions. Maybe it's a bit of all three. We don't know. Our state property tax code has almost 200 pages of highly detailed provisions regarding property taxes, things that the legislature feels are important, things that have been adopted over the decades bipartisanly. This bill doesn't have even two pages. It doesn't have two sentences. It has two words about what the property tax system would be. It has to be on a uniform basis, whatever that would be interpreted to mean. And that's it. That's the total limitation on the city in creating its new kind of a tax. We just think that that's way too broad. The district has no termination date. The only provision is that every 5 years they've got to update their plan and come forward with a new estimate, but there's no termination date. It can last forever. There's no limit on the tax amount. I mean, literally no limit, and it could be huge. Look at the list of projects that they can fund: buying land, building roads, paving roads, bridges, sewers, sidewalks, lighting. They even want to build a light rail station with this money. And that's not only in the bill, but it is in conversations directly part of their thinking. They want to use some of this money to build a light rail station. Well, that scares us. We think that that's a pretty broad authority. There is no budget or levy required. Now, they have to come up with an estimate every 5 years. They don't have to come up with dollar figures or a budget or a levy like the system in place for property taxes, a highly detailed system of budgeting and levying where you levy an exact dollar amount. So under the bill, if a property owner comes back a couple years later and says, hey, how come my tax is much higher than I thought it'd be? And goes to the city and says, how come my tax doubled? The city says, well, estimate is not an exact science. Sorry. And that's it. That's your total appeal. We think that that's pretty broad, providing estimates. There's no benefit test. They have no duty to show any benefit to any taxpayer, none, in the bill. It can be taxed for whatever reason, at whatever level. There's no approval required by anybody at any place in the system other than the city council. Once the city council decides to go ahead with this, it cannot be stopped. There's no approval by the business owners, no approval by the citizens, no approval by anyone. They do have a right to come to a hearing. They get to speak. They'll be given the plan that night. They get to look at it and make their comments, but they have no ability to effectively voice opposition to the plan other than to speak up in outrage or whatever their emotion is. This tax, of course, is on top of the other property taxes. These businesses in this district, of course, are paying property taxes for all the roads out throughout the city. They do every year. Now, in addition to that, they pay for the roads in this taxing district that they have to use and that they get to use, in addition to the roads for everybody else. This bill, unfortunately, in effect, maybe not in intention, but in effect, creates a bit of a end run around the special assessment law. Special assessment law, of course, says that that you can assess properties if you can show benefit. And as testified, the supporters of the plan are afraid they can't show the benefit to the affected businesses. So what they do is come and ask for this unfettered power, but then they say, if you don't voluntarily come up with the tax payment, we are going to collect it and enforce it as a special assessment on line 3.19 of the bill. So in effect, it becomes a special assessment without any benefit test whatsoever, totally doing an end run around the special assessment law. Whether on purpose or not, that is in fact what the effect of it is. We think that this bill is just so wide open. We think that the city and others will comment on it, have ample powers already, numerous powers. Other cities do this all the time. Development projects are nothing unique to any given city. They figure out ways to combine their various powers to do it. Our fear is that this bill is very, very precedential. And that's not just me saying it. League of Cities on its website says, we encourage cities to come forward with these bills. Newspaper articles have listed cities. There is no doubt, no doubt that if this bill passes, you will be seeing dozens, hundreds, literally hundreds, you do now, every few years, at least hundreds, of cities coming forward wanting special taxing authority. And that's under highly detailed regulated taxes, sales taxes and TIF and development districts and non-referendum bonding authority and so on. Clearly, there would be huge impact because if Minnetonka gets it, why wouldn't everybody get it? So that's our fear, that this opens up the floodgates. And Madam Chair, with that, I'll conclude my remarks. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. Are there comments or questions for Mr. Horner? And we are going to hear all the testimony, and then we'd welcome Mr. Gagne back for and Senator Bonoff for, quote,
thank
rebuttal.
You, Madam Chair.
But we'll have questions of the witnesses as we go along. Senator Olsen, you were first, and then over here. Is there somebody? No. Okay. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Horner, I carried a bill last year for the street improvement, and but my concern is that you talk about it opening up the Wild West, basically, and it's clearly, you know, going to be out of control. But yet, the district is clearly established in state law what the size of it would be. So I have a hard time, you know, I'm on the transportation committee, and we get probably every meeting, practically, it seems like we're dealing with requests from entities because they can't raise the money on a local effort because they're coming to the state to try to push that together. Now, here we have a community that's, you know, basically going to the improvements will benefit these properties, and they seem willing to be a willing player in paying for it, and the boundaries is clearly established. So I have trouble hearing your concern that this is going to open up to everybody and their brother.
Mr.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, a couple of things. First of all, on reading the bill, the boundary is actually not set in the bill. The outside limits, the area in which the boundary can be set, is in the bill, but not the boundary. The law says the council shall establish a district within these limits. It might be shaped like an amoeba. It might look like anything. Who knows? It might be gerrymandered. We'll pick up that business, but not that business. Why? Well, I don't know. That's how we're going to do it. It does not set the benefit. Secondly, our concern is that by the admitted and published work of the representatives of cities, this is the new plan. This bill has been turned down many times, virtually annually. That's true by the legislature, by several committees in both bodies of the legislature. So the new plan, and I'm not making this up, this is what they say, the new plan is now we're going to kind of slide it in city by city. That's the plan. Headline on the website, we encourage cities to do this. Here's help. Click on several links. Here's how to draft your bill. Here's how to get it introduced. Here's how to do this and that. So we do think that it opens the floodgates. And, Madam Chairman, I forget the last, you had three parts, Senator Olsen,
excuse me. Well, you'd addressed that, you know, people would be coming, knocking down the doors to do this. However, I think my point was that we're seeing that in transportation now because they can't get the financing locally, so they're turning to the state of Minnesota to get financing as part of the partnership. And you had established in your testimony that cities are doing this somehow or other, they're doing it now. And I guess my point to you is that in many cases they're coming to the state to ask for help. And this seems to me like a way where they can benefit a local area with those local businesses participating in that.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you, Senator. That which triggers the last thought, that this is supported by the businesses. We don't know that. The business that wants to develop, of course, supports it. Good company, big company, of course they'll kick in money, lots of money, probably more than they would have to by development agreement. That's one way cities work. They can also levy it on the property tax. They do it every year. They can budget for it. They can put it into their budget for property tax. City officials are afraid that the citizens will turn it down. Well, I mean, if the citizens don't want it, then why is the city pushing it? And if the businesses don't want it? Now, we don't know that the businesses want it or not. Many, many businesses, dozens, hundreds or more, I guess, that they've been listed in that district. One or two of them benefit. All the rest get to pay for it. So we don't know that they benefit or that they want to get to pay for all this stuff. So that, anyway, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Horner. The next person is Mr. Estenson from the Chamber, Minnesota Chamber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Jeremy Estenson with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I won't repeat anything that Jack said, at least I hope not. I scribbled a bunch of things out. But, you know, our concern right now is always jobs, keeping people at work. Our members are telling us that it's tough enough to keep the doors open, and this is a new tax. Now, given the amendment, I'm not entirely sure how many businesses are still going to be potentially affected by this bill, but it looks like it'll still be more than the two that would benefit. And let me say, like Mr. Horner said, we support moving forward with this project and building jobs. We just hope this isn't the tool to do it. Our folks already pay part of their property taxes that go to local roads and bridges. And I think this year we maybe especially don't support the tool because we were instrumental in helping get a transportation funding bill passed last year that generated $500 million for new roads. And there are, at least in the metro area, and perhaps greater Minnesota too, I'm not exactly sure on the timeline, another 500 and some million dollars coming to Minnesota in federal stimulus dollars. So again, to the author and to the members of the committee, we're committed to trying to help get this project done, create those jobs. We just oppose this tool to do it.
I want to pay for it. Okay. Any questions or comments for Mr. Epstenson? Lisa Frenette from the Builders, is she here? Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette. I'm with the Builders Association Minnesota. Mr. Horner eloquently put our thoughts in perspective with regards to this bill. We believe it's a precedent-setting piece of legislation that could allow and expand for this type of assessment to be placed throughout different cities. It could go to residential construction. Right now we have a major builder who lives in the area that would be affected by the increase in this fee on their property taxes. Something that I'd like to point out as part of a precedent that concerns us, if somebody ever used this and expanded into residential construction, is there's a lot of talk about affordable housing around the legislature these days, and we like to talk about housing that's affordable. Every time a fee or a regulation is added on to a development or a house or anything with respect to what we do, we need to increase the price of our houses in order to offset the cost. And that cost goes back or falls back onto the person who or the person who purchases the house. And every time we increase the cost of a house, we ax a lot of people out of the market who are able to purchase the house. So that's our concern.
Thank you very much, Ms. Frenette. Any questions for her or comments? Thank you very much. Alyssa Slander. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Members, I want to be very careful about my testimony and echo Mr. Horner's comments to be clear that the auto dealers in no way have any opposition to United Health Group's expansion or the reconstruction of the bridge at 169 and Bren Road. That is absolutely not our issue with this bill. We do, however, share the concern of the previous testifiers because of the serious precedent that this sets for allowing the birth of a new taxing mechanism for cities. As it has already been stated, this is the first in a long series of bills to follow, and that is what truly concerns us about Senate File 709. A bill was already introduced this week giving Sleepy Eye the authority to impose a street utility fee. I'm told Eden Prairie will have a similar bill this session and many others. And members, although this project in particular is very worthwhile, and no one would argue with what Senator Bonhoeff is rightly trying to do for her community, I just would urge you to please consider the ramifications of allowing a new taxing mechanism like this to come to life under these circumstances. So, members, in the interest of time, I'll quit. With all due respect for what Senator Bonhoeff is trying to do for her community, I do urge you to reject Senate File 709.
Are there questions or comments for Ms. Slander? Kay Rocco. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIAP, which is the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing the interests of developers, owners, and managers of commercial real estate, along with the thousands of businesses that are the tenants in all of our buildings across the state. And again, for the record, I have to say, as others have, we are in no way at all opposed to the expansion of United Healthcare. And we're interested in job creation as much as anyone because it's people and employees that fill our buildings. But for many years, we have had a very firm position opposing street utility fees, transportation improvement districts, street improvement districts, whatever name you want to put it. In our opinion and the way we look at it, it's just another tax against property. And as commercial real estate developers, we've really noticed over the last 10 or 15 years that when a new development or redevelopment occurs, frequently the cost of changes to improvements to the transportation system have been borne by the developer and the primary business or businesses that will benefit from the development. So I guess you could say on one hand that this legislation is very positive for our industry as commercial real estate developers. But in addition to developing properties, we also are owners of properties, and we also manage properties on behalf of investors not only here locally but from across the country. And so we and they are very concerned about bypassing the regular special assessment and special service district process with their unique protection for the property owner. And this is not the first time a city, a developer, or a business has struggled to find ways to pay for transportation infrastructure improvements. Some of these developments don't go through. Many of them do, because there are many traditional sources for transportation funding available. And I think one could argue that never before in the history of the state of Minnesota have we had so many dollars available for transportation as there is right now. And that's one of the reasons that we were strong supporters of the transportation bill last year, is because of its promise to provide local funding for transportation projects. And in our opinion, this legislation just gives a city broad taxing authority without the traditional safeguards for property taxpayers. And we are extremely concerned about the precedents that it would set. It would seem that if a city needs to fix roads, to more money for transportation infrastructure, they should go to the benefiting property owners. They should go to their voters, make the case, and then use existing mechanisms that are in place to raise the necessary money to get the job done. We don't understand why there's a need to bypass the existing protections for property taxpayers as this legislation does. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brockow. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Brockow? Senator Rolstein?
Madam Chair, I understand, because I came from local government on a county board or a school district. It's hard to raise money locally, and this is geared, it says right in here, non-residential homes. So a homeowner really doesn't have a dog in that fight. So how do we balance economic expansion when a lot of the tools that are available are kind of disappearing, especially like levy limits and those kinds of things that cities are playing within? So I think that's kind of, when you answer that or ask that question, I think that's the answer, is because a lot of those are no longer options.
And I, just for the record, we are opposed to levy limits, but we still believe that there are options available locally to raise money for transportation infrastructure needs.
Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair and Ms. Rako, I am hearing a lot of things about we're looking at the bill that we have in front of us, and we're looking at the project in front of us, and what I'm hearing is that we have businesses that are pulling this along. We're not hearing about businesses that are opposing this, and we heard at least two names of major businesses there that are going to be adding a lot of jobs. Do you know of any businesses that are in this district that are opposed to it?
I would suspect that there are hundreds of businesses in this park. Well, I know there are hundreds of businesses in this park, and I would suspect that if you were to knock on every single door of every one of the businesses in the park, you might find three or four that are even aware of this legislation.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Rako,
Senator Carlson,
did anyone do that?
Actually, we've kind of started the process.
Do we have a name?
I'm sorry, do we have a name?
Name of a business that's opposed to this.
I'm not at liberty to say that right now, but hopefully we will be able to get somebody, that couple of these business people that will be able to talk about it. But right now, I mean, they're not even aware of it, and it takes a while to digest some of this as well, too, and what the implications really are.
Yeah, thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Bonnock, did you want to answer any of the testimony, or Mr. Gagne?
Madam Chair, I would, before I make any comments, I'll let Mr. Gagne.
Mr. Gagne.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just comment that we have met with a number of the associations, and they basically reiterated to us what you heard today, which is there's a lot of talk about precedent. Very little talk about this specific bill. And I would ask the committee if you could please address this bill that is in front of you, because it's not like the previous legislation that has been introduced. There are similarities, but this is highly targeted. In fact, it's a very specific district. I'm not sure that the first testimony was, I'm not sure how much of that was even close to accurate. This is a very specified district. If we'd like to write into the bill something even stronger, that it will be those boundaries. If there's any doubt about that, that's what the district will be. We could certainly be glad to specify that more tightly. It cannot be used to build stations, transit stations. It can be used to build the infrastructure that would help support those stations. There's a CIP every year that the city develops that's part of this whole planning process. Every year that's published. Every year there are public hearings on that. Every year there are specific dollar amounts assigned to that. I'm not sure where they're getting this information. I keep thinking that this is maybe more related to previous incarnations, but it certainly is not this bill. There's a very specified appeal process. If any business does not like the fee that is being proposed, they can go to court to oppose that fee. That's actually written into this bill. This isn't something that is done in the dead of night. I mean, there are all sorts of hearings. In fact, we expanded the notification. It's not the day of. There are 60 and 90-day notification periods that are required in this bill. And it's, like I said, there's a very logical process for any individual business to appeal. Property taxes, as far as this mistaken notion that there are all these other avenues available to pay for it, there are not. I'm here to tell you, why do you think cities are looking for this sort of thing? We cannot come up with $5 million to pay for our share of an infrastructure that would allow 3,000 jobs to be created. And I would question who some of the testimony is representing. I mean, are they truly representing their members? Their members cannot expand. I mean, if this bill does not pass, those 3,000 jobs will not happen. and I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. You can't be for jobs and then say we don't like this mechanism. There is not another mechanism. There's a 30-year sunset built into it. There is a sunset. This doesn't run forever. It's 30 years because it's capital projects. We need a length of time. We could make it 10 years and then triple the amount of the fees, but that makes no sense. We want to spread this out over.
Where's the 30 years?
That was in the amendments, Madam Chair. It was introduced today at the request of the businesses. The way cities do these major projects like now is we blackmail the developer that wants to expand. So a developer comes forward and they say, we need to build. We said we can't accommodate that unless you pay everything up front. Now, there's no fairness in that. Everybody else in this entire district that benefits that do not pay a penny. That's why this is a fair mechanism. It's transparent. This isn't under the – this is probably the best tax policy law that's been in front of you. Especially – I can't speak for the League of Cities. I'm sorry I'm getting a little wound up here, but I don't think it's possible to be for jobs. I think it's highly hypocritical to say we're for jobs, but we don't want to allow the city to use any mechanism that would work to actually allow those jobs to happen. I would be more than willing to take contributions from the members of these associations to pay for this, or the state. I mean, that would be our first choice. If anybody else is willing to pay for that, we're willing to, with your enabling legislation, make this happen. If it doesn't happen, those jobs in this economy this year will not happen.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gunyu, I'm sympathetic to the need to do the actual highway improvement projects to ensure that the development and the expansion of those jobs can take place. But I am concerned about what Mr. Horner said regarding some of the transit development projects that could be available under this legislation. And I see that in lines 2.14, it references that the taxing authority could include development for fixed transit infrastructure. And then also on line 1.15 for right-of-way acquisition. And I'm wondering if you could speak both to those specific sections of the bill or those lines and what your intentions are, the city's intentions are, but then also just speak generally about what besides the actual laying down the concrete to build the new infrastructure for the overpass and the things directly connected with that, what else are you looking to do?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, it's the immediate need is for that bridge, and that's the $20 million project. In addition to that, there are technically what has to happen is to meet MnDOT standards, the bridge has to be raised 4 feet, and then everything back from that has to be brought up. So it's much more expensive than just replacing that one bridge. In future years, as part of this whole planning CIP process, we anticipate that it would be used for other improvements as other businesses want to expand. This is very directly the immediate need and the biggest need by far. The roadway structure in that office park is taxed, the entire roadway structure, not just the interchange. As far as the light rail, the Southwest Rail Line will run through this office park, and they are planning a station stop in the middle of the office park. You'll notice in the fixed transit infrastructure, it's very closely defined that does not include cars, rails, busways, that sort of thing. It would only doesn't even allow us to pay for feasibility studies or any of that. It would simply allow us to pay for the infrastructure that might support that. So if there are roadways leading to the new station stop, when a new station like that comes in, it will tax the amount of traffic that goes in and out of that area. We will be responsible for paying for that. So this would allow us to do that.
Mr. Gunyu and Senator Bonoff.
Senator Sieben.
I am really uncomfortable with that proposition. It's one thing to come here and represent this as a expansion for this specific road improvement project or the overpass, but to then try to establish a system where later the city could be using this taxing authority to develop infrastructure for a transitway development, for instance, or a station. I am pretty uncomfortable with that because it's not maybe this is an issue more for the transportation division, but it just seems that this isn't the right mechanism to be funding those types of projects.
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, I would be willing to offer an amendment to delete that section. So that would be lines 2.14 to lines 2.18.
Senator Bonhoeff, and I would make that motion for you. Mr. Gunner, you didn't speak to the right-of-way acquisition in lines 1.15. Is that in reference right-of-way specifically for the road improvement projects?
Mr. Gunner?
Madam Chair and Senator Sieben, that's correct. I'm sorry I neglected to mention that. Right-of-way acquisition is always part of every road project.
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, so not right-of-way having anything to do with the transit.
Right.
Senator Sieben.
Senator Bonhoeff, I'll just refer to council on how to clarify that, right?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, it might not hurt to simply say right-of-way acquisition for roads or streets or whatever it applies to.
That's the intent.
Roads and streets.
Senator Sieben makes the following motion to add on line 1.15 after acquisition. Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, the amendment would be page 1, line 15, before the semicolon, insert for roads and streets.
For roads and streets. And to delete lines 2.14 through 2.18.
And Madam Chair, to make the internal, you got to get rid of the or on 2.13. Minor.
Yeah, right. And delete the or on 2.13. All those in favor of that motion?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion on Senate File 709? Seeing none, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoeff, I just wanted to make sure I understood this. So would it be but for the expansion of United Health Group, the project would not have to be done, or would it still need to be done?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'm going to let Mr. Gunew answer.
Mr. Gunew.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that's the immediate need. To give you just a very brief history, United Health Group wanted to triple the size of their headquarters. Basically, they're in one building already. We could approve half of their expansion a couple of years ago. So they built one tower a couple of years ago. As part of that approval, we said this will completely use up all the capacity for the entire park. So no one else can expand until we do something with this interchange. So that's the immediate pressing need. But you'll notice in the handout that we're actually estimating 4,000 jobs over time because we fully anticipate other businesses in the park to expand in the future, even though they're not knocking at the door today.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bono.
Senator Roebling, with the addition of the Southwest Transit Way, I think we will see significant expansion in that office park. I think that will be a catalyst for future growth and expansion, and so that's also important to get this interchange done now.
Senator Betzel.
I just have a technical question, Madam Chair. On page 3 of the bill, lines 3.1 to 3.3, it refers to the fact that the municipality may apportion the street fees on a uniform basis to all eligible property in the district. And then the A4 amendment, lines 1.4 to 1.5, says that any affected property owner may have the fee apportionment reviewed by writ of certiorari in Chapter 606. I'm just wondering what that refers to in the A4 amendment about having the fee reviewed.
Mr. Gunew.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, this was an amendment that came forward at the request of one of the business groups that wanted to have it specified that there would be a clear avenue of appeal. So We will set the fee, obviously, after working with the businesses. We want this to work. But this specifies that they have the legal right through this existing state statute. The Chapter 606 is the state statute that allows the legal appeal of how that levy is set. Not levy, but fee is set. And I think that goes to the point of one of the other testimony, is that this is very clearly an avenue and a right of businesses to appeal that to a court. In other words, if we can't justify that this was done logically and not arbitrarily, then they have the right to appeal that, and it could be overturned.
Senator Betzel.
And that's because I'm not familiar with what is in 606. So this appeal would be to the district court to do that, then? Is that where it goes?
Mr. Gagneau?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Loring?
Yeah, and I guess, I think Jack Horner had a problem with the area not actually being specified in the statute, and Mr. Gagneau suggested he'd be game for fixing that so that it was clear exactly who was there and it couldn't be gerrymandered. I guess we could probably do that on line 2.30 without a great deal of work. I mean, it might read a municipal street improvement district, strike within and replace it with defined as the area bounded by, something like that. And then we'd know, and there wouldn't be the opportunity to gerrymander or anything like that. I would offer that as a possible amendment.
Mr. McGowan, would you repeat the amendment?
Madam Chair, as I understand it, would be on page 2, line 30, delete within and insert defined by.
Everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion? Senator Day.
Madam Chair, and the question is, the entire city council, was that unanimous?
Mr. Gagneau,
for you to be here,
the city council unanimous in its support of this bill?
Oh, Senator Rest, the council did not. You mean in support of this bill?
Yeah.
We did not vote on that, but certainly this was discussed with the council, and they support me being here.
Okay. Madam Chair, why didn't
Senator
you vote?
Day.
I mean, this is quite a big project, and you have a pretty wonderful city, and we have. When I drive around the metropolitan area and I see all of these great business districts that we have up here, and none of them have had to circumvent the voters of their communities to get something done. In other words, if you go out to Eagan and they have a wonderful area, and they didn't have to form a district. So I'm just wondering why the city council, I would have felt a little better. I guess the next question, could this have been done through a tax increment financing?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Day, let me ask, answer both of them. I'm sorry.
I said, God forbid, but go ahead.
Yeah. let me answer both of those. Senator Day, actually, the council did, this was part of our annual CIP that we adopt every year. In other words, this was part of the strategy going forward. They didn't specifically vote on this bill, but the concept was authorized. As far as the TIF, we actually did look into that with a great deal of interest, but it under the TIF requirements now, it doesn't come close to qualifying because it's not a dilapidated area. It doesn't meet any of those tests.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I just, Madam Chair, I mean, the voters in the cities, and I was on a city council, I was on a county board, so I spent some time. So the city council, I mean, I guess they should go on a record, which I guess they will here very shortly, and have their names out there that they feel they would like to circumvent the voters in their city to form something that they would have totally control over. And I guess the other thing that hits me is all of the people that are opposed to it, I mean, where is, you know, Senator Bonhoeff, why not bring whoever these businesses are that are going to reap the benefit of this, have them here and testify? I mean, dealing with, no offense, but dealing with city administrators and city managers and whatever, I think we're all aware that people need money nowadays, and the only people that have the money are the people that own buildings and run businesses and are working for a living, and sometimes it's easy for us as legislators or workers in government to circumvent things to get dollars from them, and that, I guess that's the only thing that bothers me about it. I am really worried about that. I don't think you're going to see me here with something in Owatonna, because I don't think I buy into that philosophy. But I can see that all of the cities that ring Minneapolis and St. Paul surely will be here very quick if they realize that they don't have to vote on the city council. They can go to the state, have us approve something, and then they can just go tax people and build something. It doesn't seem right to me, but anyway.
Well, you know, Senator Day, that a number of cities do indeed come to the state and they say, notwithstanding all the tax increment laws, let us establish a tax increment district as we define it. And we don't want, we want zero, we want right down to zero, we want this, we want this, we want, notwithstanding every single provision of the tax laws. Well, they're not doing that. They could have done that. There could have been a special legislation. We see it every year for individual cities that want to put aside the tax increment law and go about their economic development. Now, Minnetonka's not doing that, and this might be something novel, but don't say that there aren't cities that come and say, we don't want to go to the people, and we want to set aside the economic development law to do what we want, because they do, and they do it all the time.
Madam Chair, the reason these people are here is because if they went to the people in Minnetonka, it would be voted down.
But cities come and say, we don't want to go to the people to vote. We want a special tax increment financing district. So this is not any type of anything that is cities asking for special authority to set aside the law or to create new law. It's not the case that it doesn't happen. It happens all the time. This is not a precedent in
Madam
doing
Chair,
that.
I'll respect your opinion. I will tell you this is much major than that, much more major than that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Senator Day, the voters, I bet, would vote yes in this case because the voters
wouldn't
be the residents and they don't have to pay for it. So so in this particular case, I think we'd win that okay. on that one. And so the mechanism in this is that the city council will have to give notice to all these businesses and there will be a public hearing. And I used to sit on that Minnetonka Planning Commission, and you can be there till 2 in the morning and listen to them, and they will have their day to communicate. But I hear you, Senator Day.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Bonhoeff, you already have a pretty good start on a long list, and I would bet by probably in another day or two, or where you, by the time you get to the next committee, it'll probably be doubled or tripled. So it probably will,
Senator Betzel.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Often when we get the legislation that applies to one local jurisdiction, we have some local approval clause. Is that needed in this particular bill? Do they have to take a vote by the
Mr. Gunn,
City Council to adopt this?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, it does require us to adopt the plan for that. But if you'd like to add some sort of we do truly view this as enabling legislation. In other words, we would have to enact it. If you'd like a formal vote of the council to make that happen, I think that's wholly appropriate.
Well, Madam Chair.
Isn't that in?
Isn't it in here?
Subdivision 7, Senator Betzel, on page 3.
It is.
It's in a few places. It requires them in subdivision 4 and in 7 that they do have to adopt the
by ordinance,
plan by ordinance, and I was just raising the question whether that's sufficed was sufficient for the local approval clause or not. As I say, I don't know one way or the other if that does or doesn't. I don't know.
Well, Madam Chair, I think Mr. Gunyer was right. This is enabling legislation. It's not something the city has to do. They may do it if they want to, but they're not required to, and that is one of the exceptions. If you look on page 2, line 29, the municipality may, by ordinance, establish municipal improvement street improvement districts. So that makes it enabling, which is one of the exceptions from the local approval requirement.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas?
I apologize if this was covered because I've been in and out because I had a bill up in another committee. But if this interchange needs to be done, and it's a state road, right? It's a MnDOT road. Why is MnDOT not doing it? I mean, where are you on the MnDOT list to get
Senator
this accomplished?
Senator Bonoff, and you might want to explain about the stimulus dollars, too.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, in terms of the priority, this is really an economic development priority, so it's not that this interchange and this bridge is structurally deficient or that, you know. So MnDOT's very interested in this because it's in keeping with Commissioner Sorrell's new philosophy in terms of public-private partnerships and taking advantage of economic development opportunities as quickly as possible. So they have been aggressively pursuing all sorts of options, including putting this at the top of their list with regard to stimulus dollars. Mm-hmm. But even if we were to get stimulus dollars, it would not cover the entire project because of all of the sounds like the modifications that need to happen around the interchange in order to have this happen. I personally wish the stimulus dollars would just cover the whole project, and I'm going to continue to advocate for that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
And Senator Bonoff, are there any county funds available that you're using also to assist with the project?
Mr. Gagneau?
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, there are not. It's as 169 is a state road and Bren Road is a local road, then it's between the state and us. And I should emphasize that both MnDOT and Deed have been very, very supportive of this. In fact, I talked with Commissioner McElroy this morning, and he indicated it would be a high priority of Deed, and they're working to try to get us qualified for whatever funds are available. This piece that enables this would allow us to do about a fourth of it, which is the amount that we're trying to do. It would be about $5 million. We have been working with Deed to qualify for one of their loans, but this does not authorize us to issue bonds or anything like that, but we could use this as a mechanism to pay off that loan then that Deed would issue for us.
Is there further discussion of Senate File 709? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in opposition or in support of this bill? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate
Madam
File
Chair,
709.
Chair, before we move on this, I just had one more question, and that is
Senator Pappas.
A sunset clause. Yeah, have you already added that in?
It's in the bill.
All right, thank you.
30 years. Senator Lori moves that Senate File 709 as amended be recommended to pass. Senator Day.
I would like a roll call.
Roll call.
Madam Chair, does it go to another committee from here, or where does it go?
I never got to finish the motion.
Okay.
Senator Lori moves that Senate File 709, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Transportation. The clerk will take the roll. I'm first.
Senator Rust?
Yes.
Senator Lori?
Yes.
Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Betzel?
Yes.
Senator Carlson?
Yes.
Senator Day?
No.
Senator Gimsey?
No.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Marty? Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
No.
Senator Vickerman?
Mr. Chair, this has another committee or two to go through yet. I'm going to support it, but I got mixed feelings about it.
A yes with explanation.
Roundabout way to get the yes.
It's okay.
Seaman.
There being seven ayes.
Madam Chair.
Oh,
I'd be happy to not vote if you'd like to.
My apologies, Senator Seaman. Senator Seaman.
I'll vote yes.
There being eight ayes and four noes, the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you,
Bono.
Madam Chair, members.
The next bill is Senate File 334, Senator Pretner Solon. Senator Pretner Solon brings us Senate File 334. Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
A little order here. Senator Pretner Solon.
First of all, Madam Chair, I have a delete all A2 author's amendment, if someone would be so kind as to move that for me.
I would move that, Madam Chair.
Let's have the members get it first, and then I'll call on Senator Seaman.
I would move it.
Well, she already said she would. It's a love in here. Does everybody have the amendment now? Not quite. Okay, it's coming. Senator Seaman moves the A2 amendment on behalf of the author. All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Fails, and the amendment is adopted. We now have the bill in front of us.
Thank you.
As the author wishes us to consider it. Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 334 began with an email from a constituent who happened to be a disabled veteran and a state employee. Steve DeHaan, who is with me today, contacted me about the number of sick hours he uses for a one-hour appointment at the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis. He lives in Duluth. I learned that for every appointment he has, he uses 8 to 10 hours of sick leave. The drive alone from Duluth round trip takes Mr. DeHaan almost 5 hours. I realized that this must also be true for many other full-time disabled veteran employees in greater Minnesota. Senate File 334 would provide state employees who are military veterans and have a service-related disability with 40 extra hours of sick time to take medical appointments for that service-related disability if their sick leave balance is insufficient to receive treatment for their disability. The employee would receive the additional 6 hours once their application is approved by their appointing authority. This amendment was requested by management and budget to tighten the parameters under which an employee would receive the additional sick leave. And I am sure that they are willing to answer any questions that members might have about the language of the amendment also. And Mr. DeHaan is with me today to tell you more about his situation and the need for this legislation.
Mr. DeHaan, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record. We're pleased to have your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Stephen DeHaan, and as the Senator said, I am from Duluth. And I appreciate you taking your time to listen to my comments, what I feel is a very important issue. I am a disabled veteran. I am a state employee. My job is a radio communications operator for the Minnesota State Patrol. I do need to emphasize that I do not represent the Department of Public Safety, Minnesota State Patrol, or AFSCME in any way in this matter. I represent myself as a citizen of the state of Minnesota, a disabled veteran, and I have proudly served my country for 6 years and the state of Minnesota for over 18 and a half. There are many disabled veterans serving the people of the state of Minnesota. There are also many state employees serving in Guard and Reserve. There are many more veterans returning home with injuries and disabilities that will need continuous care. I can't imagine a new employee coming home from Iraq or Afghanistan missing a leg. He has no sick leave. If he needs to go for treatment, he won't get paid. This is simply a start. I'm working with Senator Pretner Solon. She has been absolutely wonderful. I cannot say anything more greater about her taking this issue. In the last year, for VA medical appointments, I would have used a minimum of 70 hours of sick leave. Fortunately, I do work afternoons, so that was cut down greatly for my daytime appointments for the local VA clinic in Superior, Wisconsin. And I do understand there are many reasons to oppose this bill for financial reasons. And many people feel that this would be a labor contract issue. Now, labor contract issues can change every 2 years. Not all state employees are disabled veterans. Not all state employees would benefit from this type of legislation and may be willing to drop it during a negotiation period. I feel this is just a small start for veterans coming back, ones with more serious conditions, just for the state to say, thank you, we will help you all we can. We understand that what is going on. My eventual goal in this is to see even more. I am presently working with AFSCME on labor contract issues concerning this, actually, for different types of a sick leave bank that a veteran could use that does actually have sick leave hours. The state does pay veteran or guardsmen and reservists to go to their duty. I feel that the state, I served my country, I got injured serving my country. Just simply a separate sick leave bank. Sick leave is sick leave, no matter what, that person is going to be off work. And I apologize. Again, I do have many goals. I am very passionate about this. I would actually like to see this out into the public sector as is required by employers to allow guardsmen and reserve to go to do their serve their time, their 2 weeks, their weekends, and so on, without any repercussions. I would like to see that public employers would have to allow a disabled veteran time to go to his medical appointments, whether he has sick leave or not, and whether or not public employer may not pay them, but they. The veteran deserves the right to go to his appointment without any fear of repercussion for his job.
Thank you, Mr. DeHaan. And on behalf of the committee, we also thank you for your service.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Bodern informs me that there's a technical amendment to the delete all that needs to be adopted. Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair, the head note reflects it. Page 1, line 5, after veteran, the bill should have the words with a service-related disability inserted into the text. And one other clarifying item on page 1, line 11.
Isn't that in the delete all amendment?
No.
Oh, in the, I'm sorry, in the text of the, not the head note, but in the text, yes.
One other item I think would be useful to avoid any confusion would be on page 1, line 11. It just would be clear that the section itself once each year wouldn't inhibit any additional sick leave under other sections of law.
Senator Putner Solon?
I have no problems with that, Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben moves the amendment to the delete all amendment, and Mr. Bodern, would you repeat it one time?
Madam Chair, page 1, line 5, after veteran, insert with a service-related disability. Page 1, line 11, delete additional.
All those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Vickerman?
Madam Chair, it's really a sad state when we have to do something like this for veterans who have fought for our country. We should automatically do it. I'm going to move this bill because I think it's the right thing to do.
Senator, just a moment. Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 334, as amended, be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? Senator Sieben.
Madam.
Senator Betzel. Or Senator Sieben or Senator Betzel.
Go to the Finance Committee.
Yes. I'm going
okay.
to get there.
Gotcha.
I've got it written right here, Finance.
Gotcha.
Is there any further discussion?
I had one.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Pretner Solon, would this apply to veterans who have mental health disabilities?
Senator Pretner Solon.
Madam Chair, I would assume that it would apply to any veteran who has a medical disorder or related service-related disability, and if that's mental health, then I would assume that would apply to that also.
If Senator Pretner Solon,
Senator Sieben.
You might just want to check, maybe work on the language as it moves forward to make sure that that's the case. I just would want to make sure that even if it's not a veteran, doesn't have is defined as a disabled veteran, that we would be sure that mental health coverage would be included.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, actually have a service connection for PTSD, which would be considered a mental health issue. The way the VA classifies it, it is just if you are disabled, whether it be mental health, physical, or otherwise, they just consider you to be disabled.
Okay.
And actually, my original suggestion for this sick leave amendment is just a separate sick leave bank. And in actuality, that wouldn't cost the state anything more, because whether you use sick leave from pocket A or pocket B, you're still using sick leave. And like I say, I do understand that there may be a union opposition to it as just being a condition of employment. And I do understand that, and again, I am working with that. I would really, really like to see this as just a simply when you fill out a time off slip, you mark VA medical appointment, it is taken from a VA sick leave bank, that is, you're just given to you 40 hours. When that is gone, it's gone. But this is a very good start to help, especially new veterans in state employment, returning ones that have had problems for years.
Exactly. Senator Lori, did you have a comment?
No.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Sieben's actually making a pretty good point. I mean, it's one thing if the person has a service-related disability that's defined by the Veterans Administration for PTSD or some other condition. But if the Veterans Administration has only indicated that there is a physical problem and they haven't diagnosed a mental health problem, and the person feels that they need treatment for mental health, does this cover it or not? And I'm thinking that the way this is worded, it may not. I mean, if you can only get the leave for the service related disability, and if the VA doesn't determine a mental illness as part of that, then this may not apply. So I think Senator Sieben might raise a good point that maybe this needs to be checked into.
Madam Chair, we
Senator
do have
Senator Pretner Solon.
There is somebody here from MMB who would be able to respond to that.
They'd be welcome to come forward, or as they do. Is there anybody else who wants to raise a question for them? Welcome to the committee. How do you do?
Madam Chair, members.
Pleased to have you here.
For the record, I'm Judy Plant, Assistant Commissioner at MMB, and we've been working on this amendment as well. Our understanding is that the key words are veterans with service-related disabilities, that is a phrase that brings up definition from the Veterans Administration. So it is linked back to that definition. Certainly any veteran who has mental health issues that have not been designated by Veterans Administration, that would be covered under ordinary sick leave for sure. So I'm not sure that helps clarify.
Well,
Senator Betzel.
Then just to be clear, then, the leave would only apply for treatment that the VA the Veterans Administration has identified as being related to the disability, not anything more.
Senator Pretner Solon or Ms. Plant?
Madam Chair, that was our intent.
Are there any other questions or comments?
Okay.
Is there anyone in the audience who, in addition to Mr. DeHaan and his plan, who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just a slight deviation from the previous question. Suppose that the employer or MMB commissioner were to determine that this person needs sick leave because of a diagnosis that is different from what the Veterans Administration said. Could that be approved or not?
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Plant, hoping
Ms. Plant.
That she can answer this.
Madam Chair, Senator, the way that this this piece has been written, the access to the 40 hours comes when a veteran has exhausted their normal sick leave possibilities, and because of their service-related disability, they need additional time. That's when it would kick in. So it's for that purpose. As with all state employees, when they exhaust the use of their sick leave, they have to follow the normal procedures for when they need time off or to request FMLA and those typical remedies. So,
is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 334, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All who are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator
and committee
Dahl
members.
Here. Senate File 767. Thank you, Mr. DeHaan and Senator Prettner-Solon. 767, Senator Dahl, Metropolitan Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought this was going to whiz through on this bill, but I'm afraid now we might be here all afternoon or into the evening. These are a tough group. Madam Chair, members, Senate File 767 really is a pretty simple bill. It's regarding the Metropolitan Land Planning Act of 1976, making some changes to make that more efficient. This bill does basically three things. The Watershed Management Organization will notify the council when it receives a local water management plan or a plan amendment on a timely basis. It also will, the local units of government, when they do a new land management plan, they will, if they have an existing water management plan on file that's current, they can just use that as part of their land use plan, or they can and provide an executive summary. But if they apply a new water management plan to the watershed district, they also send one directly to the council at the same time. And then the final thing that this does is it kind of brings it into the 21st century. Originally, units of government had to submit their plan to adjacent governments and related districts or affected special districts and give them 6 months to review it. We're going to trim that down to 90 days, and in fact, As this is the first committee this has been heard, I'd like to offer an author's amendment, if I may.
Senator Dahl, the bill says 60 days.
I know, and that's where that's the amendment we want to make. On line 2.4 of the bill, we want to change that from 60 days to 90
Senator
days.
Senator Sieben moves on line 2.4 to strike 60 and insert 90. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's really the bill, and I have Judge Shetnin of Met Council here to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Shetnin or for Senator Dahl? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to this bill? Senator, let me just see if there is. Is there anyone? Seeing none. Senator Olson.
Thank you. Could you just give us some background on what's dry? I think I understand, you know, government approval on things stretches projects way out, so they get way off a date. Is that what's driving this? Or?
Mr. Shetnin.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, that's exactly what's happening.
Mr. Shetland, you need to identify yourself.
My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, that's exactly what's happening when Senator Dahl says we're taking this to the 21st century. Back when the Land Planning Act was put in place, cities had 6 months basically to review adjacent cities' comprehensive plans. We've been through that process now, and we're finding out that we don't need as much time. And actually, when we drafted the bill, we had 60 days in there, which was an agreed-upon time amongst ourselves. League of Minnesota Cities supported it. The Association of Minnesota Municipalities supported that as well. However, AMM came to us and said that there are some city councils that need a little bit longer because they may only meet once or once a month. So to add that extra 30 days would be helpful, and if we could do that, then there would be absolutely no problem with this bill. So that's we're all in agreement, and we'd appreciate your support.
Is there further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves that Senate file 767 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, Mr. Shetland. Senator Moore brings us Senate file 407.
Madam Chair, may I take 764 first?
Sure. We'll move to Senate File 764, the Indian Affairs Council Electronic Meeting Authority. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I believe there's a delete everything amendment.
Members have the delete everything amendment. Senator Olsen moves the A1 amendment. This is an author's on behalf of the author. All those in favor, I guess I have to vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Moore.
Madam Chair, members, Senate File 763 was 64, as introduced, was brought to me by the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And the amendment now has changed a lot of what the bill as introduced was. But let me provide a little bit of context. You know, under current law, we have permitted certain agencies to have the ability to hold electronic meetings. And so when the Indian Affairs Council came to me, they just wanted to be given permission to do that. Since the bill has been introduced, though, I've been contacted by a number of other small state agencies that they would like to be able to do that. And, Madam Chair, I believe I've spoken with you. The Delete Everything Amendment basically goes into the statute and makes this permission now applicable all across the board. And if you look at the language of the Delete Everything Amendment, it basically spells out the permission to do that. I mean, there's not much more to the bill than that. For members who are concerned, though, there is a reference back that obviously the open meeting laws will be complied with, so everything else stays. It just provides for a mechanism for these electronic meetings. I have the director for Indian Affairs Council, who is the legislative liaison, who is going to speak very briefly on why they need it, and then Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board, I believe, is also here, who's just going to speak very briefly as to how they can benefit from this bill.
Okay, and Mr. Bodern, this is just boilerplate language that we have seen in other sections of the law to allow such meetings to take place, generally speaking.
Madam Chair and members, there's actually a list in the summary of all of the other sections in law that use very similar, if not identical, language. The standard provision.
I see. So I would direct members' attention to that. It is not anything new.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
So I'm trying to understand if we're allowing this for all state agencies, or are we allowing it state agency by state agency? You know, can't we just allow it for all state agencies?
That is what Senator Moore is trying to accomplish here. Right now, we have had any number of bills over the years that come in and ask that specific authority for a single agency, and Senator Mua was approached by at least two with regard to this bill and decided that she would have drafted a more general application. I don't think I don't think we need to go in and repeal the other authority simply because we're giving general authority here. That would be too cumbersome. But from now on, we would not have to have the Board of Electricity come in and ask for specific permission.
Right.
As I understand it, it would be granted under this authority. Okay. Senator Betzel?
I do have a question, and if we're just copying what's in the other statutes, maybe it's addressed somewhere else, but I'm going to delete all page 1, lines 21 to 23. It talks about the fact that each member participating is considered present at the meeting for purpose of declaring a quorum and participating in all the proceedings. Suppose that you establish early on that there's a quorum, but somebody is disconnected, hangs up, whatever, is no longer part of it. So there technically it may not be a quorum anymore, but it may not be apparent, you know, to the participants whether there's a quorum or not. How would we know that?
Senator Betzel, I think the once a quorum, as I understand it, once a quorum is established, unless someone proposes or imposes a quorum call, the quorum is in effect until the end of the meeting.
And that's easier to do when everybody's sitting there.
Bodies.
You may not know if somebody's been disconnected. Now, I do note that every roll call has to be by, or every vote has to be by roll call.
Yes.
So at some point, that's going to establish whether they're quorum or not. But I just was wondering whether or not, you know, you may not be a way to challenge a quorum if you don't know that somebody's been disconnected. So until you actually get around to a So somebody may be intending to participate, but you know their line goes dead. The battery in their cell phone goes off, something, whatever.
Madam.
Senator Moore.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I did contemplate that. And my thinking is that that would happen only in a context where it is a telephone conference only. But as we move forward, I think it is becoming increasingly common for people to do teleconferencing on the television with visual conferencing with the facilities available. So I think that the language here, I think that could happen with just telephone only, but the language here is drafted forward-looking that in instances where we're doing teleconferencing by visual conferencing, I think that that would address the problem. And I do think that the roll call is helpful in making sure that we continue to have people present in the meeting.
Briefly, as the bill or the delete all does provide for telephone or other electronic means, so you know telephone is part of what is specifically proposed
yes.
here. So.
Ms. Shoptees, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Jolynn Shoptees. I'm the Legislative Director for Indian Affairs Council. And the reason why we approached Senator Moore with this bill is our board of directors is made up of the tribal chairs or their designees. And at any meeting, our board members will come from as far away as Grand Portage and White Earth and as far away as Lower Sioux and Upper Sioux. So at the most, people are driving at around at 8 hours to come to our board meetings, and this is something that they requested that they be able to simply teleconference into the meeting if it's not possible for them to be there. There's no fiscal note on this. In fact, it would save our office a lot of money in traveling and hotel costs.
Is there a further question? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Moore, the only thing I've seen here is about any kind of recording of meetings is about the votes, but in these other commission meetings, board meetings, and such. I'm not positive, but I mean, I think that the proceedings are recorded, things like that. Under this proposal here, would they still be recorded or just the votes? Are we going to be losing some of the record?
Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, Senator Gerlach, I guess I hadn't thought about that, but I guess I would defer to maybe Ms. Bodden or somebody who have some experience with how this specific area of the statute has been used by other agencies that have obtained this permission from us. So, I mean, it isn't like this is brand new language, but this is boiler template language that we've borrowed from other instances where we're using it elsewhere. And
furthermore, I would imagine that if these organizations or agencies operate under some sort of bylaws that would require not only that they're subject to the open meeting law, but that they have to keep a record of their meetings. This is an additional requirement rather than supplanting requirements, is what I would think, Mr. Botter.
I just wanted to raise the issue. Just I didn't want to lose that ability to record the proceedings because they're doing this.
Madam Chair and Senator Gerlach, the bill doesn't provide any exemption from any existing requirement to record the meeting.
Would you like to testify?
Madam Chair and members, my name is Lori Bark-Penske. I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division at ADMIN, and we help the Commissioner of ADMIN issue advisory opinions on open meeting law. Currently, open meeting law only requires the taping of closed portions of meetings. There is no overall requirement that meetings be taped. Many of them are by local agencies and state agencies, but there is no requirement.
But there are general rules under which these meetings are conducted, and they're not exempt from those rules here. Mr. Goldsmith? Welcome to the committee, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board. When we typically track bills that relate to the open meeting law, and when I saw this bill, I contacted Senator Moa and expressed interest in the board being a part of the bill. At that point, it was in the Indian Affairs Council statute, so I withdrew that request, but she kindly worked with Mr. Bodern to make it of more general application. And as the members have noted, there are some 17 other agencies that already have this authority in their own individual statutes. And so the board is happy to see this being brought into the open meeting law itself. We are a board of 6 members. Typically, we have some retired persons on our board because by law we have to have 2 former members of the legislature. And it's turned out over the last several years at least that one or more of our board members tends to be out of the state during some of the winter months. So with 6 members, we have to have 4 for a quorum and 4 votes to pass anything. And we found it difficult to establish a quorum sometimes in January, February, or even March. Likewise, if we've had to have a special meeting, sometimes it's difficult to get a quorum. So we would welcome this. We would not use it, I think, the way the Indian Affairs Council intends to use it as a more regular practice, but rather we would use it on those occasions when the members aren't able to all get there, or at least 4 members aren't, or if we have 4 there and a 5th is available to participate by telephone. So we think it's a wonderful addition and would add to the flexibility of the board in being able to conduct regular meetings and to have all of the members participate. With regard to recording, we are required to record our executive sessions. We will continue to do that, of course, and we don't record the public session, and that would continue as well.
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair and Senator Moa, thank you for bringing this. I think it's a great idea. I had an opportunity to participate in several phone-in meetings, and I was just amazed how well it worked. I dialed the number that I was given, and when I called, the meeting had just started, and I heard everything that was going on. I was able to participate. It saved me the trip, and I was really grateful for that because certainly in this day and age when we're trying to figure out how to reduce some costs, I think this is a very good idea.
Is there further discussion? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, Senator Roebling.
I would be happy to move the bill.
Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 764, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Moore, Senate File 407.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Senate File 407, there's an A2 amendment that I would ask the committee to adopt as an author's amendment.
Senator Lori moves the A4 amendment on behalf of the author. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 704 before us as the author wishes us to consider it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Much of the amendment that you just adopted is technical in nature, and there's one substantive change from the bill as introduced. So as I go through the bill, I will point out to you the areas where we've created some change. But as by way of context, Madam Chair and members, 3 years ago, Minnesota as a state was invited by the National Conference of State Legislatures and the Forum for Youth Investment to join a consortium of states to participate in long-term, multi-year policy, Youth Policy Institute to generate and share ideas about how to be better at maximizing outcomes for the investments that we as a state make in children and youth in our various states. Senate File 407 is one of these shared ideas. The language for Senate File 407 mirrors similar language passed by the state of Tennessee in 2008. It also includes components of which have also been implemented in other states. So what does Senate File 407 do? Senate File 407 asks for the Commissioner of Finance to design and oversee a resource mapping project that will include all federal and state funding sources and streams that support health, safety, permanence, growth, development, and education of children in the state of Minnesota. And we asked for some parameters for this project. So it may include, but it's not limited to, and the bill lists what some of those resources and programs are. But in the paren 1, where it says an inventory of all federal and state funding sources, the A2 amendment restricts that or tries to help define that to sources that are primarily intended for the support of children in the state of Minnesota, including prenatal services. And then as you look down the list, we ask that they take into consideration targeted population, geographical region. And so Subdivision 1 describes sort of or presents a general parameters of how to do the mapping project. Subdivision 2 on page 2, lines 2.1 to 2.3, asks that the commissioner periodically update the resource map and maintain it so that it's timely updated and has the most updated information. The rest of the bill asks for other agencies to cooperate to furnish the necessary information that the Commissioner of Finance may need. And then there's a reporting requirement. And so the A2 amendment does a couple of things that are a little bit that adds to the bill. For one thing, as you can see in the A2 amendment at line 1.9, we ask that the commissioner solicit public input. We also ask that the commissioner, in particular, seek input from individuals who have conducted relevant research at higher education institutions and from individuals with relevant experience at nonprofit institutions and foundations. And the reason for this is that there has been a lot of work done on resource mapping. This feels like it's new to government, but resource mapping is a practice that has been done in other arenas, and I think that it will be informative for us to solicit input and assistance from those individuals. The reporting requirement in the A2 amendment has put in there, instead of February, we're asking for it to be in January in case some ideas or recommendations come about where we need to make some statutory changes. And then finally, I asked Mr. Bodden to help me make sure that the information that we provide is in the electronic version and that it be an executive summary so that if the respective chairs or members of the respective committees would like to see the larger report, that they could get that, but that we provide it only in the executive summary in electronic format, and that in instances where there has to be a printed or full report, that we would make it available on request, but we don't do it automatically from a resource savings perspective. And that is the gist of the bill, Madam Chair and members. I only have one testifier here today, and that individual is Mr. Steve Poprocki, who is the managing partner at Access Philanthropy, who has extensive experience in this area. I've invited him to come to share his experience and perspective, but really also to be a resource to the committee members.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Senators, I am Steve Poprocki. I'm the managing partner for Access Philanthropy. We are a national philanthropy research center. And I have been an author and editor for several fund mapping programs, including one recently for the Minnesota Department of Education on their out-of-school time program funding. Basically, you have some testimony in front of you, so I won't go into it in what our credentials are and what we do, but we're here to support the Senate File 407. We have worked with several foundations and businesses and corporations all over the United States and, in fact, all over the world in creating these fund mapping projects. And we find that there are several different benefits to it, some of which are listed there. I just want to go into a couple of them. One is that, all of them have a financial return on investment. First of all, the major piece is that there is a duplication of funding and gaps in funding. Fund mapping resourcing goes into covering what those areas are and what how to change that. Secondly, fund mapping often will identify terms of long-term projects and long-term effects of funding. So, for example, the Ford Foundation recently did a study. We did a study for the Ford Foundation in Africa and found out how much funding was going for women's organizations, women's education especially in Ethiopia and Kenya and that area. And what we found out was that in the long run, the Ford Foundation funding was not doing any good. And so consequently, the Ford Foundation has recently changed its policy towards funding for women's organizations in Eastern Africa. Thirdly, there's a common taxonomy. As you know, the language of different bills and different agencies changes from time to time and changes from program to program. One of the things that fund mapping does is actually to force a common taxonomy, which makes it easier for everybody to understand. It also actually reduces cost because there isn't this sort of translation process that has to go on. We think that there's also a benefit because you are able to track who's getting what kind of money, where is the money going to, and what is the benefit of it. In that regard, it's probably one of the most effective tools in terms of evaluation that we can find in terms of how federal and state money is being used. And finally, it also helps us to identify different sources, where the sources are going to. Are we talking about young children? Are we talking about rural children? Are we talking about children preschool? What are the demographics? And are we talking about families? Are we talking about children themselves? So there are several different things that fund mapping does good for the state. We strongly recommend it, and frankly, we can tell you that there are a few states already that have done this fund mapping. There, virtually every state in the United States has some nonprofit organization or some agency that has been doing sort of fund mapping, and so there isn't a need to reinvent the wheel. It's already there, and frankly, we think it can be a relatively cheap process and a great evaluation tool for the state.
So, Madam Chair and members, let me just give you this final thought, and then we'll take some questions. As I mentioned earlier, the language in our bill mirrors language in the state of Tennessee, which passed last year and have been implemented for one full year. They have now done their preliminary report back to the legislature. And one of the areas that they identified, they are reporting really good results, and they have put in place a really good process to go forward with how they can implement this. And so certainly we can look to them as a model for this, and they, I think they would be more than willing to come and consult or help us to do that. But the one thing that they identified that was a challenge for them was that they had to go back and sort of retrofit their budgeting system to help make this happen. Minnesota is in a unique position because right now we're at a place where our budget system is being reexamined, and we're on the cusp, I believe, Senator Betzel, of acquiring and putting together a new budget system. And so I just feel like this bill is so timely in that we shouldn't pass up the opportunity to do something like this, to build this into our new budget system that we're doing. And I don't think that because we're already doing that, if we can build it in, it's just too much of a good opportunity to miss. And so, you know, Madam Chair, members, I think that Senate File 407 is a bill that's really about good government. It is about responsible and research-based policymaking, and it really helps us to have some clear directions and ensures that public expenditures really maximize the kind of outcome that we desire. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Moore. I do have a question about that. I wish you would explain a little bit more about changing the report date. January 15th does seem to be a little bit early to have a report due at the beginning of the year when people have been on vacations and things like that. And I wonder if maybe not February 15th, but if some date in between might be more reasonable.
Madam Chair, I'm open to the will of the committee. I just chose January 15th because I thought that was a date that we've used in other committees for other reports.
I'd welcome an amendment to make that a little bit later, if anybody is inclined. Well, Senator Betzel.
I'm sure I've been actually the one who's led this charge over the last 17 years, because it used to be that every report was due on January 1st,
right,
which made no sense.
Right.
And so that people really were working over the holidays to get reports here before the 1st that nobody was even going to look at. Now, this says by January, but by of each year. Now, we don't know when the even-numbered year is going to start, but the first year of the odd-numbered year is when the legislative session starts. So if we're going to have reports in by mid-January, is not a bad time to get them in. I mean, they've been working on it for quite a while, if it's going to be due every single year. Frankly, if it's going to be due at a later date, it may get caught up in other business at the legislature and, you know, may not be a very effective. So January 15th has actually worked quite well.
Okay, then.
Madam.
We won't move on that then, but I do recall that we have been tried to be sensitive to the end of the year of schedules for most people in preparing reports that need to come to the legislature, and rather than make them scoff laws, we've tried to make the date.
Madam Chair, I know that as we move forward, if the agency comes back and says, you know, a later date will work, or this is just to put it into the statute, and my goal here is to make this as workable as possible for the people who are doing this work.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Paprocki. This is a really, really interesting idea, and I think really important. I was at a conference a couple weeks ago on college readiness and high school to college transitional programs, and it made me think about that we really don't have a handle in Minnesota of all the, you know, college, federal, private programs that are out there to assist young people in preparing for college and the transition to college, and that we needed to do some kind. And I didn't know what it was called. And someone at the meeting said, "What you want is a landscape analysis."
Right.
So, what's the difference between a landscape analysis and fund mapping? Or are they kind of really the same thing?
Madam Chair, Senator, the landscaping is a more general sort of mapping. It includes private foundation funding. It includes sometimes in kind contributions. Fund mapping is really where is the money right now, mm-hmm. and where is it going to? It's a more limited mapping of the process.
Senator Pappas.
Well, Madam Chair, but it did sound that in your description, you did look at, you know, federal funding and private funding, mm-hmm. as well with the fund mapping.
Yes, I mean we use it. I'm sorry.
You need to go through the chair.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do use it for all different kinds of things. Generally, though, when people call landscaping or environmental scans, it's more public policy as well as dollar amounts.
So, Madam Chair, so it could be like programmatic differences, yes. and overlap, not just money.
Exactly.
Okay.
Madam Moore. Madam Chair, let me just say that this bill, I shamelessly took it from the Tennessee model, and I want to take ownership of that. The bill was introduced, and you scheduled me for a hearing, and I was trying to identify really good, capable people who are working in this field to come and help bolster my argument that this is a really good public policy idea. And I called Mr. Paprocki like a week ago. And so this is not something that he brought forth, but he is an expert in this area, and I look to him as a resource as we move forward in this effort.
Thank you, Senator Moore. Are there other questions from the committee members for Senator Moore? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Please come forward. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Yoakum with Minnesota Management and Budget. And with apologies to the senator, our offices missed each other today. We're not speaking in opposition to the bill by any means. As the senator mentioned today, the department is in the process of building the new budget information system. That will be up and running. The schedule, I believe, is for early next fall, I believe by October, and to be in place, fully operational for the next budget cycle. So at least as far as what we're seeing right now, what's proposed in this bill would probably be one of the first major tests for the new system. One of the issues that we just need to bring up that I think has to be addressed by the legislature as a whole is obviously this is a sizable amount of data, but when you look at the state budget as a whole and all the information that goes into that, and I know many of you members have heard us speak ad nauseum about the MAPS system, it's a lot of information, a lot of lines of data, and to be able to do all the sorts of that type of data takes a significant amount of memory, and to make a system that's robust enough, our system we're hoping is to be robust enough to really. Right now you have a very static information system that goes from the MAP system into the current budget system. Hopefully the new system, real-time data, very robust and can take in the activity codes. But the legislature will have to really set the parameters of what they're looking for in those activity codes. The department is working very closely with legislative fiscal staff in both chambers in order to make sure that what's being created is responsive to the legislature's needs. But today is an example that we have to make sure that this fits into a bigger environment and make sure that global discussion is happening, and so that the department has a very good idea of what the legislature's wants and needs are to make sure that we're not, as was said in Tennessee, there was a need for a retrofit and trying not to take a brand new system and having to retrofit it every couple of years. And so we'll definitely be working with the author and members of the committee going forward. I just wanted to express that.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else? Seeing none, Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'll move that Senate file 407, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred
to
the Finance Committee.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your time.
Senator Gerlach, just a minute, Senator Rowling. Senator Gerlach has informed me that he will not be able to be here on Friday, and we may not get through all of our agenda, so I'm just going to take his bill before yours, Senator Roebling, and then we'll see how far we get to the rest of the agenda. But he said he's not going to be able to be here on Friday.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
So we'll go to number 11 on the agenda, and then we'll come back to Senator Roebling's 515. Senator Sieben moves adoption of the subcommittee report. All those on Senate file 804. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the Senate file 804 as amended before the full committee, and this bill will go to the floor. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Now, this bill was heard in detail in the election subcommittee, and I believe that everybody around the table is part of that, with the exception of just a couple. Yeah, right. I know Senator Betzold and Senator Roebling and Senator Vickerman, I think, and Senator Lurie. But this is simply the Secretary of State. Did I miss somebody? No.
It is almost everybody.
It's half. Half have heard it.
The Secretary of State's housekeeping bill. And Ms. Fraser, Beth Fraser, who was here last time, went over article by article, all 22. I don't know that I need to do that in this committee unless somebody really feels that that is a necessity. I had gone over it with Ms. Fraser, and also we went over it, like I said, in the subcommittee, and I have agreed that all of these items are non-controversial, that they are housekeeping items, and that they all make sense. And so that's what we had to discuss there. So, Madam Chair, I guess without going through detail, I could certainly do my best to answer any questions anybody might have on any of these articles.
Does anyone have any questions on a particular section of the bill that you might want to direct to Senator Gerlach without having him have to go through the whole thing?
Madam Chair?
Senator Olsen.
I did have one. You know, we had talked about that. I think in our last subcommittee, we talked about how to fill out the ballots, you know, because it had said Xing, and is that in this bill? You know, because there was a provision
that where they change it to filling in the oval or drawing the line as opposed to marking an X. Is that in this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, that in Senator Olsen, that is not part of this bill.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Roebling.
On page 3, line 29, it says that we're going from 3 to 4 election judges for each precinct, but there's an exception, but I'm not quite sure. What prompted that? I know there's some really small precincts out there that I'm wondering if they are supposed to have that many judges.
Certainly, Madam Chair. And I,
Senator Gerlach.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling. Which section are we looking at?
Section 7, page 3, okay. Line 29. We're raising it. It says a minimum of 3 has been canceled. 4 election judges shall be appointed for each precinct.
Okay. Yes, Madam Chair, I can tell you that I asked a question about that myself when we went through that, and it has to do with here's somebody who might be able to answer that. But it has to do with
the summary says that it's a clarification that 4 judges be required at all elections. Ms. Fraser, we're looking at sections 7 and 8. That question raised by Senator Roebling on page 3, starting with line 328.
You would explain this to me,
yes,
in my office, but I don't recall exactly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. I was listening and suddenly heard you were doing this bill, so I'm out of breath because I ran. So excuse me. Since the legislation was changed so that in almost all elections there needs to be electronic voting equipment, the statute already requires that there be 4 election judges with very limited exceptions. So this doesn't really change the law, it just makes it more clear.
Senator Roebling?
Do you have any further questions? I guess it looks like it changes the law from 3 to 4, but I just
Madam Chair,
I'm not sure.
I think the answer's in the summary.
Is in where?
In the summary where it says, Madam Chair, it says, clarify, core election judges are required in all elections except those elections with an exemption from the requirement to use accessible equipment. So I suspect a very small precinct may be allowed not to or not be required to use an electronic machine.
Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, if you look at the repealer, 204B.22, subdivision 3, says that the minimum number of election judges is 3 plus 1 to demonstrate use of the machine. So that's for all elections that use electronic equipment. So we're getting rid of the adding, 3 plus 1, and trying to make it more clear to everyone that it's a minimum of 4 with very limited exceptions.
Okay. Any other questions for Senator Gerlach? Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, it appears from the summary, I had questions on the expiration date of the city council terms and the school board terms in sections 16 and 19, but it appears in the summary that this just codifies some session laws that just aren't on the books, but we've already passed them. That appears to be the case. The question that I do have regards the school board, school district transitions, and as I'm reading through, I'm trying to understand if a school district...
You're looking at section 19, Senator?
18, actually.
Section 18.
If a school district transitions from an odd year to an even year, does that extend the terms under which the incumbents are serving, or just how would that happen, or shorten them, or how do you work that out?
Madam Chair, if we're referring to Section 18.
Section 18,
That was deleted as an author's amendment in the subcommittee.
Okay.
So, and Senator Betzel, to your other question, the reason that we want to put the session law into the statute is because the Secretary of State's office is getting calls all the time asking this question because they're just looking at the statutes. Nobody knows enough to dig into whatever year's session law. So this will put it all in one place so that the election folks can see that.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify in favor or in opposition to Senate File 804?
Do these on Friday.
Seeing none, Senator Gerlach moves that Senate File 804, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Roebling. Senator Roebling brings us... first bill is Senate File 515. Senator Roebling. And members, depending on how long these next couple of bills take, we'll go maybe a little bit longer than 5:30, but the other bills, other than Senator Roebling's, are mine and Senator Pappas's. Senator Pappas, will you be able to be here on Friday? Okay.
Pensions.
Madam Chair, there's a pension commission, but you know, Senator Pappas bounced back and forth between the two of them last Friday, so I wish you could do it
meeting
again.
In the Senate? Huh? Are we meeting Friday in the Senate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 515 removes the age cap of less than 22 from the current PELRA exemption for interns. Under current law, interns are exempt from the provisions of any collective bargaining agreement or the requirement to pay union dues if, and there are currently four reasons, and there's quite a few things. Positions are temporary or seasonal, were full-time students prior to being hired by an employer and have indicated an intention to continue as students during or after their temporary employment. They do not work for more than 100 working days in any calendar year, and they are under the age of 22. Members, I'm not proposing to remove the first three reasons that they would be exempt, only the provision that they be under the age of 22. And today I think everybody recognizes that college education is no longer just limited to individuals between the ages of 18 and 21. Many people, including service people and many immigrants, delay their college education until later in their lives. With the current economy in particular, but even before that, many people have returned to school to get educated for a second career. And even if they get higher, you know, it's still not something that is easy to do. You know, there aren't that many internships available. But I think it is almost an age discrimination that we don't let somebody who is over the age of 22 apply for those positions that might be available for a paid internship. And I actually came across this bill because the Minnesota Intercounty Association had it as a provision in their legislative platform of things they would like to have done. And today I have Doris Krogman with me from Carver County, who was one of the people who saw a need for this, and I'd like to have her explain how why she thinks this is important.
Welcome to the committee, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm Doris Krogman, Employee Relations Director at Carver County. I realize you have a little bit different title for me, but I really am the Employee Relations Director.
Okay.
And this year I
have... We will change that in the minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
This year I am chairing the MICA HR Directors Group. I'm speaking in favor of the narrow change to the definition of public employees to allow individuals beyond age 22 to participate in public sector internships to the same degree as those under 22. The narrow expansion of the definition of intern that we support is simply the additional 33 days of work these would-be interns living within the current 100-day internship would be required to have. We see internships as a win-win situation. The student enriches their formal educational pursuits with a practical application of their newly acquired knowledge. The public sector organization pays a slightly lower hourly rate to these individuals in recognition of their investment in the students' on-the-job learning. The organization often provides a mentor or other close supervision in such an arrangement. The intern contributes to the needs of the organization while learning more about their professional goals and life as an employee in that profession. Not everyone attends college right after high school, and not all required internships are within the bachelor's degree programs. Veterans, immigrants, and students in PhD programs are now excluded from participating as interns to the same degree as the more traditional college student. People are changing careers and returning to work later in life, especially in this economy. The HR directors in MICA would like to have equal access to this group of less traditional college students as interns. We would also like to provide these lifelong learners a full 100-day exposure to public sector work, which we see as meaningful, honorable, and important. We also would like to make sure that we're able to compete with our private sector counterparts who might be vying for this same talent. In today's market, we realize that there are more workers than jobs available, but the demographics indicate that the future holds a very different situation for us, where public sector employers are going to need to be very competitive. I urge you to support Senate File 515, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments for Ms. Krogman? Senator Rolstein.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a daughter who just worked on a master's in social work and did an internship, and she was over age 22. How could she have done that?
Ms. Krogman.
Madam Chair, Senator Rolstein. People call a lot of things internships, and what we're trying to do here is work within PELRA to say these particular situations are internships. In cases where something is unpaid, it is often phrased as an internship and sometimes is seen as an internship through the educational institution but not necessarily through the employer. The other situation is there is a 67-day limitation for other temporary employees, and some programs allow it an internship that is of that duration, so we don't need to exercise the additional 33 days that we're talking about here. So perhaps one of those situations applies.
A follow-up,
Senator,
if I may?
Olsen.
Thank you. Obviously, counties are going to be feeling the ramifications of what happens with our budget solution. I guess there's concern that, you know, are they going to be turning to interns as a way to replace regular staff people that might have been lost their job because of budget cuts? I mean, it seems like it might be. I was on a county board, so I know how these guys are trying to figure out how to make every dollar go as far as they can. So what guarantees do we have that a county may not say, well, because I got to say, there are school districts that don't offer insurance, and they just hire people, and they have them there for a year, and they move on. What's there to keep counties from just hiring people on an internship? The internship's done. They replace them, and just as a way to manage their budget in a very tight fiscal era.
Madam Chairman, Senator Olsen, a couple of things limit that quite a bit. One is an internship is fairly cost demanding on the employing organization, the county in this case. If we bring an intern in, we're obliged to give them the time and attention to make sure that they have a meaningful learning experience. They're not just coming in as another worker. So their role is quite limited in most situations, especially those requiring some kind of credential to do the professional work. It's extraordinarily limited, and they tend to work side by side with another professional individual. So it's not what I would call a ready workers force at all. It's really an investment in the future that we bring these people in, we dedicate the time and resources to their learning, to do real work in the real workplace, and hope that upon finishing their credential, they might look back to public employment and join us or another agency like ours to do that.
Are there any other questions? Senator Roebling, you have another witness?
Yes, Madam Chair. I have Dan Hennen. He actually is a volunteer intern in my office this session, and he comes to me as a non-traditional student, and I'd just like him to explain his situation.
Mr. Hennen, thank you for being with us. If you would identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Dan Hennen, and I'm currently doing an internship with Senator Claire Roebling. Prior to the internship, after graduation from high school in 2001, I joined the Marine Corps, so I'm also a student veteran. Upon release from the Marine Corps, I moved back to Minnesota here and began my studies at the University of Minnesota. I'm currently studying public governance and business management. Through the University of Minnesota, I'm doing a class on legislature and affairs and so forth, and that's why I'm doing an internship with Senator Roebling. I represent a non-traditional student at the University of Minnesota. I can let you know that there are a lot more non-traditional students. If it's people that are student veterans, if it's just people that were delayed their education, or they are deciding to pursue a different career.
And Madam Chair, he came as a volunteer for this position, but his degree might at some point, you know, want him to get another job in government, and he could be blocked out for anything that would be paid, especially. And so I guess that's not what we want to do. A lot of the non-traditional students, especially if they're immigrants or people who maybe have been unemployed and are changing careers, actually probably are more in need of paid internships than the younger students are. And so I guess that, you know, that's one of the points of just limiting or lifting the age cap on here and trying to make sure that we give opportunities to all students. And again, I reiterate that there still are a number of restrictions in place here that make sure that they are indeed students and that they are going to be very temporary.
Thank you, Senator Roebling. And Mr. Hennen, on behalf of the committee, we also offer thanks for your service. Questions from the committee?
Madam
Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, I'd be much more comfortable if we had some language. Supplant is a new word that I've heard so much this year. You know, you can't supplant the legacy funds or something. Could there possibly some language that says, you know, interns cannot replace permanent employees or something like that? Or it's a concern for me because I truly do feel that as we go through what's going to happen to counties, they're going to be really grappling to how they're going to staff their positions that they need to fill.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm trying to understand the language on page 1.17, even current law. Mr. Bodern, does this mean that even if you're over the age of 22, you could still be an intern if you didn't work for more than 67 working days?
Yes.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, that is correct, without limitation as to your student status.
So that, Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, actually that allows you to work 5 days a week, if my math is correct, for 3 months, or like a lot of our interns who only work 2 days or 3 days a week, you could do 6 months. So, I mean, I guess I think that it's there is enough flexibility there for people who are over age 22 that I'd be nervous about taking up a PELRA bill this year, given the kind of fiscal pressure that we're under. I would rather not kind of open up the PELRA and make changes, honestly.
Madam Chair,
Senator Roebling.
Senator Rest, I have no other intentions with this bill. I came to try and help some students that need some experience and maybe some pay with that experience. And, I guess from a practical point of view, if you consider who normally supports the PELRA provisions, and you outnumber us 2-1. So there shouldn't be much risk of anything happening here. if anything else gets added onto this, if there would be another attempt, and I'm not going to attempt it, but I can't imagine that anything else would be able to get attached to this. So I don't know that the fear is realistic.
Mr. Carlos, do you wish to testify?
Madam Chair, I was really just here to respond to the questions. I will respond to the
you
question
to
about
yourself,
supplantation. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of Minnesota Intercounty Association. In practical terms, this issue of supplantation, I would suggest to the committee, just really does not exist. In the first place, to meet the criteria of the intern exemption, the individual has to be enrolled as a full-time student before he or she starts this internship. So they just literally do not have the experience that they can provide great utility to the employer during the course of their internship. Second place, as I think has already been enumerated, the 100 days is the equivalent of about 5 months. I think that is an important distinction with the general 67 days because 5 months is approximately what is a semester and is frequently the duration of these internships that people get for credit. They have to work for that entire semester to get credit, so 67 days will not suffice. Just bottom line, the supplantation issue, by the time these individuals are trained, at best, they're potentially providing the utility of a regular employee for, I would guess, 2 months duration of that five-month period. Ms. Krogman, I'm sure, could comment better on how long it takes to train an individual in to get up to full speed in their position, but the issue of supplantation, in my opinion, just simply does not exist here.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I am Julie Boyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5.
Ms. Boyle.
We are opposed to the bill that's before you. Tom Stinson has indicated that we're faced with up to 3,400 layoffs of public sector employees in the state. We view this bill as another exception to PELRA, the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. And simply said, we do not need any more exceptions to the work that our public employees do, and we urge you to vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Blyle. Did you wish to testify?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark McAfee of the AFSCME Council 5, and I just point out that there's talk about internships, et cetera, and I think that a person could work. Some of the people that we represent, for example, out in the Minsky campuses, we've got clerical staff, we have custodians, et cetera, and the way we read this, certainly a student could take, could conceivably take one or more of those positions. And so it's we would be opposed to it, especially in this time where we're certainly probably going to face a number of layoffs in those institutions.
Are there questions or comments for the witnesses? Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, and I've got a question here for the witnesses because, I mean, this does apply to interns, and I mean, Sarah Olsen has talked about the fact that we don't want to try to supplant interns into other positions, but all what the bill basically does is it strikes the age limitation on page 1, line 18, so that, because right now the employees have to be under the age of 22, so that would be eliminated. But Sir Roebling's witness talked about the fact that, you know, he was an individual who, you know, I guess went into the military service, came back, and went to college after that. And so, you know, clearly that, you know, some people get too old because of that break in schooling. Is it possible that we could still maintain the intention of this exception by, instead of just deleting under the age of 22, just raising it up somewhat to, say, age 25, 26, or whatever, to account for those kinds of situations? Is that a possibility? I know Senator Roebling or the witnesses.
Ms. Blyle.
Madam Chair, our view is that by increasing that age or eliminating that age, either way, you're weakening PELRA. And for that reason, it's expanding an exception to PELRA, and we would be opposed to it.
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I wouldn't have a problem, although I still think we'd be discriminating against some of the older students, raising the age to, say, age 30. I know Dan is 26 years old already. And you, typically internships, and I would even say we could say that they're seeking professional careers, perhaps. And if we could put that in so that they're not going to be taking a job like custodian, because that isn't the intent. Typically, these internships are for students in four-year degree programs, and they're on a professional track. And I think it is to our benefit as a state, county, city government to give them opportunities. And it may lead to future employment, certainly full-time employment, if they work out well with whichever entity they're with. And so it's an entry point. It's experience. It's something that there may be more members for the union afterwards, because some of these people will indeed be employed by those entities if they show a good work ethic and good responsibility during their internship. So I would be willing to raise the age rather than have no opportunity for those. And that would be especially helpful for some of the military people, perhaps, who went immediately into the service after high school and come back and use their VA benefits after they get out.
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I think 8 years is quite a jump. From what the law is now, I was trying to accommodate the person who would, I think 4 or 5 years went, but I was thinking along the high end when, for my thought, is 28. I'm not quite sure where the rest of the committee might be, if they're even interested in that, but let me mull on this for a minute or two, Madam Chair. So.
Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, I guess I really want to reiterate that I think there's plenty of room in existing law for these internships to take place. 67 working days, as I said earlier, would be 3-month internship if you worked for 5 days a week. That's a good internship, 3 months. Or if you only came in twice a week, it would be more than 6 months. So I really think that current law is adequate to deal with opportunities for college students. We all work with college students all the time. They come into our office during session 2 days a week, and they get a good internship from that.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olsen.
Senator Pappas, maybe I'm understanding this wrong, but with the age 22 in there, then they can't do that. That's my understanding.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas?
I asked Mr. Botter, and my first question was, does that first clause, number one, on page 117, is it affected by the age 22? And it is not, because that there's a semicolon and there's an or. So there's no age limit if you're not working for more than 67 working days in any calendar year.
Thank you.
That's okay.
Senator Seaman?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, I just like to express concern over this bill, given what the testifiers have said, that we're facing more than 3,400 public sector layoffs potentially. And I think back to my days as an intern, and what I did was answer telephones, file, do clerical work. In some of my internships, it's almost like you do fill in for the staff, who may or may not be there at that time. And so expanding it to allow for potentially for there to be more internships in the future, I just think is a slippery slope that we might want to wait to do this in another year.
Could you check your email?
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Ms. Krogman would like to respond to one of the concerns raised.
Ms. Krogman, come back to the table. And thank you for your testimony.
Open. Just be aware. Open to them.
Madam Chair, I would like to comment on the age 28 or 30. When we have guardsmen or guardswomen who have been in primarily inactive duty status for many years and have just recently been called to active duty and may be 35 or 40, and finally qualifying to take advantage of an educational opportunity, I am reluctant to turn that group away for an age limit if I get to choose. The second group of people that we have seen, and this is a group that is required to have a six-month internship is my understanding, and it is a six-month close to full-time internship, which means the 67 days doesn't get them there, and the 100 gets very close, is a PhD candidate for psychology. And these are people who, are going to go out and work in the world of mental health, and it's a place where we're concerned to have people working. And if we can attract those people to public sector long-term, I think we're in better shape as a competitive employer to do that. I can't speak to every county, but I can speak to Carver County. Many of the people who work in those psychology programs are in roles and on a professional level where they are reimbursed through some series of health insurance, and I realize that's also up for grabs right now, so I understand I can't count on that. But again, if I can attract a few of those people to public sector, I think we serve ourselves very well to serve the needs of the underserved long term. Thank you.
Senator Gerlach first, and then Senator Lurie.
Well, I'll pass.
Okay, Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, you know, the whole discussion has been framed around this intern, but I would like to say that this law, as it relates to PELRA, is not just solely related to interns. I mean, it's for seasonal and temp with less than 67 or less than 100. It can be much, much broader than just these interns that are using these positions for, well, that's how the law reads. I mean, it doesn't say internship anywhere. It says seasonal or temporary in character and...
Right, that's right.
It doesn't say intern. I mean, so it can be, my understanding, the way I read it, and maybe I could go to council for some clarification, but I don't see intern anywhere in here. I see seasonal temp and these day limitations, which is a much broader application than an internship that I kind of understand with trying to incorporate it with education, but I think that's where we're getting the pushback.
There is a good piece of it.
Maybe I could get some council advice as to whether I'm misreading it.
Mr. Bodden?
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I think the only thing I would point out on Clause 2 is you have the conditions that are attached to that, I think, reflect someone who is basically a full-time student and intends the last part of that clause, they intend to continue as students during or after their temporary employment, would suggest that those people are most likely interns.
Well,
Senator Lurie?
Madam Chair, I mean, I think that Mr. McAfee's case of the custodial staff would be that they represent would be one example that would not be an internship, would be temporary or seasonal, would be 100 days, would be, these are the to the concerns that when you open up PELRA, and it doesn't ever say the intern that this is framed around here, and that's where a good deal of the discomfort, I believe, comes from. And
Madam
I
did Chair.
Student piece.
Okay, but Senator Pappas?
And these are paid positions, correct? Because there's nothing to prevent an agency from having unpaid internships for a longer period of time or for a greater age. And that's probably...
The beginning of the sentence says it's these people means any person appointed or employed.
Right.
So assuming that...
So unpaid internships would be much more flexible.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not covered by this.
Right. Okay. I wanted to clarify that.
Senator Betzel?
Well, I'm just following up on Senator Lurie's comment. I'm just wondering after on page 1, line 17, somewhere after the parent 2, we could just add the phrase or add a clause that says that the person has to be in an internship program. In addition, as Mr. Bodden indicated, most of what is stated here, you know, would be somebody who's a student, but nothing requires them to be actually in an internship program, so that might tighten it down to the kind of things we've heard the testimony about.
Madam Chair, I'd be open to that if I don't know if Mr. Bodden has any recommendations. I think that this has always been interpreted to be the intern section, and it doesn't say that, but that's how it has always been read. So if we need to specify, I would be willing to do that.
Mr. Bodden, do you have a suggestion from Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I think pretty much as Senator Betzold suggested on page 1, line 17, before the second not, you could insert employed in an internship program.
So what would it read after 2?
It would be clause 2, are employed in an internship program. That's right, it wouldn't read very well, would it? I think you can delete not for and insert employed in an internship program. I'm doing this on the fly here.
Maybe we could, Madam Chair, do we want to say something about being enrolled?
It does that down at the bottom.
Okay, that's true.
Madam Chair, I think what you want to do on page 1, line 17, is rewrite clause 2 so that it would read, are employed in an internship program for not more than 100. So you would delete not for and insert employed in an internship program for not.
Senator Roebling, would you like to make that motion?
I would move that amendment.
Senator Roebling is moving the to amend as read by Senator by Mr. Bodden. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there additional discussion on Senate file 515, Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, and to the members of the committee, I think that Senator Pappas outlined this well, that this bill, although its intent may be benign, has the possibility to create additional pressures on state budgets and our public employees. And even while I understand the specific case of that may occur, I still think there's enough flexibility in the law as is for students who are over the age of 22 to participate in unpaid internships. In many cases, I know, for instance, if you're a PhD student, you may receive funding to participate in that internship from your educational institution or a federal work study program. So I really just think that this is not the right direction to be going when we're potentially facing 3,400 state employee layoffs across the state, and there's no assurance in this language that interns could fill the roles of the public employees who may be laid off. So I would respectfully urge a no vote.
Is there further discussion? Senator Gerlach?
I'd like to request a roll call vote.
There hasn't been a motion yet, but when there is.
Okay. Yeah. Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
I'd move to table Senate file 515.
Senator Sieben moves to lay Senate File 515 on the table. Senator Gerlach has requested a roll call. There's no further discussion. The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Betzold?
No.
Senator Carlson? Senator Day? Senator Gerlach?
No.
Senator Gimsey?
No.
Senator Lori?
Yes.
Senator Marty?
Yes.
Senator Olsen?
Yes.
Senator Pappas?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
No.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Vickerman?
Yes.
Senator Rest?
No. There being six ayes and five noes, the bill is tabled. Senator Roebling, did you want to do Senate File 713 now, or would you prefer to wait until Friday? Because Senator Pappas and I are going to wait, but I'd be happy to have you take up that bill and you'd be done.
I have to see. I do have someone here.
Fine. Senate File 713 is before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. This is a very simple bill. What it does is it sets up a, it allows the Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget to set up a program to solicit suggestions from state employees for ways to reduce the cost of operating state government or for ways of providing better or more efficient state services. And for those individuals or teams that do that, there would be a monetary compensation opportunity. They could receive an award of the lesser of 10% of the documented savings in the first year in which the employee suggestion is implemented, or a maximum of $2,500. And the money is appropriated from the fund in which the savings occurred. So that, and I have someone with me today who actually was involved with a program like this in the private sector. And just wanted to have him share with you how that worked. He has some great ideas on how it could be set up, and some of the savings that this business was able to receive because of it. I will also point out, oddly enough, as much as the public employee unions disliked my past bill, they like this one. I had a lobbyist from MAPE come to my office today, and it was on their list of bills to support. So anyway, I will let Mr. Buckstaber talk
Mr.
to you.
Mr. Buckstaber, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Buckstaber. I am a owner of a consulting firm in the Twin Cities, and what I bring is the experience both personally within a employee ideation rewards program and administrator for those same programs. My experience shows and tells me that there are many opportunities for cost savings, and I know on your website you ask for both the public and many people to bring ideas for cost savings. My experience is that the ideas and the detail in implementing ideas and the true costs of what the savings can be are generated from the people who are actually working in supporting the processes. And several times today you have noted that there will be significant layoffs across the state. And my experience tells me that with those layoffs, it means that there will be more work with less people. The time that people have to be innovative and creative will take a secondary backseat to just producing the work and creating a steady state environment, because your work will not go away. An ideation or rewards program will enable people to think not only outside of their current environment, but in programs that I've been involved with, ask people to work together across agencies, across departments, to find opportunities for cost savings and provide the incentive of rewards for them to do that outside of their normal course of business activities. In my experience, I have seen rewards programs. My personal team, when I was an employee, was a cost savings of $28 million over the course of 10 to 12 weeks. They can be significant and they can be small, but all savings add up to greater savings. And one of the benefits is that these programs typically not only pay for themselves, but they provide significant long-term savings as well for the state.
Thank you, Mr. Booksaber. Are there questions or comments for Mr. Booksaber or for Senator Roebling? Senator Olsen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Roebling, is there an upward cap on this, or is it?
Yeah, 2,500.
No, I mean in the aggregate. Or
Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, we didn't put one on, no.
Because it's program by program.
Right, and it's a percent of the savings. So I guess I wouldn't want to cap it, because if they can think of things that would save more money, we would probably like to implement them.
General Olsen.
I agree. I think that there's nothing like a financial incentive to spur creativity. So.
And Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, you know, we are concerned about where our wages are going to go, but this would offer employees, you know, a possible bonus, some extra revenue if they come up with a good idea, and that they would be properly rewarded for it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I think this is an excellent idea. Today was MAPE Day on the Hill, and I had a group of 10 MAPE workers in that I met with, and during the course of our meeting, they had several suggestions for cost savings. So I think they're eager to help us, solve. Obviously, it's not going to solve the whole budget problem, but, you know, things like turning off your computers at night. I mean, there's lots of little things that can really add up.
Except when you try and turn it on in the morning, and it doesn't cooperate, which I find often.
That's never happened to me.
Well, I walk around with a cloud over my head, I guess. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition of this bill?
Just a clarification. I mean, nothing prevents employees from submitting suggestions now. This just gives the, you know, some financial incentive to do it. So, and right now there's nothing in law that allows that to happen.
Well, also, Madam Chair, I think that
Senator Pappas.
I don't know that I get the sense that employees sometimes feel like their suggestions aren't wanted. And so it says to them, yes, we do want your suggestions, and we're eager to have them.
Or if they give really good cost savings ideas, it's going to cost them their jobs rather than being an incentive.
Right.
So this makes it clear that this is something that's valued by the employer. Senator Betzel?
And presumably the agency or somebody's going to have to figure out a tie-breaking thing when they say, well, we like this idea, and everybody says, well, that was my idea, because it was all put in the suggested box at the same time, and who knows which came in first. So, I mean, at some point, somebody's going to argue that you've got money. Somebody's going to say, I thought of it first.
Mr. Booksaber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my eyes aren't that good, even with glasses. Senator Beazle.
Betzel.
Yeah. Betzel, thank you very much. My experience with these type of programs is some of the devil is in the details, such as determining a first-in process and an objective criteria by which cost-saving ideas are evaluated. And one of the pieces of successful implementation is to be able to actually go back to the budget manager as the final authority to get commitment from that budget manager to take it out of their budget for the next year. And those have worked very well, but there are some details. But there have been great experiences, and these programs have been in existence. So those details and those have been worked out in previous implementations of these type of programs.
And Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Roebling, I think we are ready to vote. And before we do that, there would be only three bills on the agenda for Friday, so with your permission, we will not meet on Friday and instead just add them to an agenda of either next Monday or Wednesday. Okay. Is that agreeable?
Good.
Okay. Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 713 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Thank you.